Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Tuesday, April 6th. We have one item only on our agenda. Before we get started with that, let's have a roll call.
Representative Levy.
Here by video.
Representative Marsh. She's excused.
Excused.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith is here by telephone.
Representative Valderrama.
Representative Valderrama present by video.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson present by video. Thank you. Today we have an informational meeting on data-driven decision-making. This committee often has questions for presenters about, well, who's affected by this and how are they affected? Who is not affected? What are the impacts on which groups of individuals or businesses? And I often hear questions, well, can we get that information if we don't have it now? So we have a number of agencies or persons prepared to talk to us about what information they have, what they don't have, what maybe would be useful if they could have it. And if we don't have access to that information, why don't we? Are there roadblocks? So all those kinds of questions, we might hear some answers and we might ask additional questions. Mr. Alanak, could you please describe the panel that we're going to hear from and then we'll start calling on them?
Yes, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. So before you, you have five entities. You have four state agencies, three of them are regulatory, and then you have the Office of Economic Analysis. And kind of going through the list, we have the Department of Consumer Business Services, mainly focusing on the financial sector, banks, insurance companies. And the entities that were requested to join today are those entities that the Revenue Committee tends to have more interaction with related to taxes or the economy. Following DCBS is the Employment Department. So here we have the unemployment insurance tax and all of the wage information that the department, that the state uses. And then you have the Department of Revenue, the tax return agency. That's the agency that you have the most interaction with, at least through your roles on the Revenue Committee. And those are the three agencies that have a regulatory role for the state. And then we have Business Oregon, the Economic Development Department. They use a lot of information, they conduct a lot of analysis. And then the batting cleanup, so to speak, is the Office of Economic Analysis. That's the state economist. And these are the folks who provide you and the state with the quarterly update to the economic and revenue forecast. So you are familiar with them. You see them at least once a quarter. And
good. Thank you. Let's hear first from Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson. Can you hear me?
Yes. And to make sure that I'm dotting the I's and crossing the T's, I'm opening the informational meeting. Hello, Teresa.
Hi, Chair Nathanson. How are you? Good afternoon, Vice Chair Reschke, Vice Chair Pham, members of the House Revenue Committee. My name is Teresa Van Winkle. I am the Legislative Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, or what's most commonly known as DCBS. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with all of you today regarding examples of how we utilize data in regulatory functions. In your introduction, teeing off the informational meeting, Chair Nathanson, I think my agency kind of falls under the latter in regards of questions that you can ask of us and how we can deliver data to you. I'm here today with Katie Whitehead, Research Manager, and Nathan Johnson, who is the lead, is a lead analyst for the DCP Essential Services Division. They are two of a unit of individuals that are responsible for research in the shared services category, which encompasses all divisions of DCBS. Data is also collected by each individual division. So, for example, in the building codes division, there are 300 different licenses and permits and such in the building trades construction arenas. They have compiled information on that and such. Before I begin, dive into the presentation, one big caveat. Given the breadth and depth of our functions, I'm striving to provide information, but really also open the door for you as a committee, you and your individual roles as committee members, and also in your individual role as a legislator, to reach out to the department. I often get questions of what we regulate and what we don't, because really it's easier to ask, is this something you do? If it's not you, who does? So we're used to those sorts of questions and can help you in connecting resources to what you need to get the answers that you need. So posted on OLIS is an agency organizational chart and a brief description of each of our regulatory divisions. To give you a thorough background, DCBS is the state's largest consumer protection and business regulatory agency. In our day-to-day activities, we strive to meet our mission of protecting and serving Oregon's consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate. We are a resource to both consumers and businesses, all Oregonians. The programs that we regulate and the industries we regulate impact all Oregonians each and every day. Areas of industries involve financial services, such as state charter banks and credit unions, investment advisors, all lines of insurance carriers and insurance agents. Mortgage bankers and loan servicers, mortgage brokers and loan originators, consumer finance companies and collection agencies, debt buyers, pharmacy benefit managers, and beyond. That is part of what the Division of Financial Regulation is responsible for. And I'll dive a little more into their work in a bit. We're also responsible for workplace health and safety, such as facilitating free consultations with businesses regarding workplace safety and health programs, workshops for both employers and employees on safety, providing basic health, safety, and health programs, and ensuring injured workers receive timely and accurate benefits of care and early return to work programs as well. We are also responsible for maintaining construction codes and licensure of trade workers and businesses within the construction arena, and also overseeing a statewide building inspection system, also maintaining the statewide building code, which is supported by local jurisdictions. Last but certainly not least, we also are responsible for the health insurance marketplace oversight through the federal platform healthcare.gov. We also collaborate with insurance carriers, agents, community partners, and other stakeholders to get more people enrolled. Given the nature of what we do, we collect a lot of data, both at the individual division and actually at the shared services level. So for purposes of today's conversation, I'm going to focus on a couple of things that the Division of Financial Regulation and the Workers' Compensation Division use and how they utilize data for regulatory functions. There's also a spillover effect in regards to stakeholders, which includes policymakers in making decisions on various policy proposals. Specific to insurance, the Division of Financial Regulation is the keeper of Oregon's insurance code. As the insurance regulator for the state, they are entrusted with oversight in the areas of financial solvency and solidity of the companies, ensuring that carriers are able to meet their obligations to policyholders, ensuring that market conduct is proper, that insurers do not engage in unfair practices, and that insurers fulfill the terms of their policies, and rate regulation, which ensures that the rates meet statutory standards, that they are not inadequate, excessive, or unfairly discriminatory. In the area of financial solvency, Division of Financial Regulation, or DFR, collects data about a company's assets and liabilities and their financial performance each year. They also conduct periodic market conduct examinations for individual insurers, which includes a review of the insurer's underwriting practices and guidelines, and also accuracy of the rating of policies as compared to what has been approved on documents that are on file with DCBS, and also the insurer's claim settlement practices. This is very important for consumers. This is how an insurance carrier handles disputes with their policyholders. Under market conduct as well, one of the other statutory responsibilities of the DFR is in intake and processing of consumer complaints, not just in insurance, but in financial services products as well. Specific to insurance, data patterns and trends from filed complaints can be used to evaluate market conduct. So, for example, the enforcement unit, if there is a specific pattern of violations with a particular insurer or a small group of insurer, group of insurers, the enforcement unit can delve into that a little bit further to do corrective activities. Also, in looking at the different trends and patterns, DFR can also create what's called a data call that can be used to look more in depth about different practices for insurers on that. Also, to assist regulators and rate regulation, the carriers are also required to report statistical information on premiums and losses as well. I know this is not the most exciting information in the world, but it's very important for us to make sure that we have a solid and stable insurance market in the state. As mentioned, data calls are a tool for DCVS to collect data on a variety of topics related to conduct. The authority of issuing data calls is under the Oregon's insurance code, specifically ORS 731-296. In a nutshell, what the statute provides is the allowance of DCBS to make any proper inquiries to an insurer, a licensee, or its officers in relation to its activities or condition or any other matter connected with its transactions as a insurer or insurer product. And this also I believe this also includes other entities that are regulated and which their statutory authority is placed under the insurance code. So, for example, in front of your committee this session, there are a number of bills dealing with pharmacy benefit managers. That is within the insurance code as well. When a data call is issued, the recipients are required under the statute to promptly and truthfully reply to such inquiries using the form of communication as requested by the department. This information is also subject to insurance code provisions regarding penalties for false or misleading filings. Again, the data call statute is applicable to all lines of insurance. So besides providing our internal regulatory functions, the data call has also been used by stakeholders and legislators in shaping public policy. One prominent example of such usage is the examination of insurers' reimbursement of mental health providers and reimbursement rates. This was required for DCBS to conduct through the enactment of Senate Bill 860 from the 2017 session. In regards to how the statute is used, there really is no criteria for things such as the duration, the length of questions, what have you on that. The statute is meant to be flexible in providing adequate inquiries by the department and also the ability for carriers to respond to that. Specifically to Senate Bill 860, this was arguably the largest information compilation in recent memory. It required the 11 health insurance carriers in the state between the periods of January 1st, 2015 to June 30th, 2018 to provide data in a variety of different areas in regards to mental health services. I think almost a million different data points that were compiled in that. In the bill required for us to do a status report to the legislature. It truly is a status report. I know that, but I believe most of the activities have been conducted. This is probably more of an exception to the rule. Another recent example, although this was a few years ago, triggered Chair Nathanson's memory. We did a data call in regards to, when there was the meningitis breakouts at the university campuses, the division was responsible for issuing a data call to the carriers that sold and provided student health plans to look into coverage and seeing what gaps in coverage were there and needed in regards to the cost of the meningitis vaccines that the various universities and community partners were establishing.
Teresa, I'm going to give you a chance to catch your breath for a minute. We've heard about one division. There are many divisions in your agency, and yes, we have several other speakers.
Yes.
I'm going to cut to the chase here and pose a situation to you.
Certainly.
Very much at the forefront of conversations this year is looking at things through a racial equity lens.
Yes.
We also, throughout the year and over many years, we have questions about, well, does this particular tax or this particular tax credit or this particular application of the law, does it disproportionately or adversely impact small business versus large business or small communities versus big cities? are you able to have access to what you need? Or in the case of violations, are people in some counties facing inquiries or investigations more often than people in other counties? You know, speaking of looking for patterns. So is there anything you can share with us about what DCBS knows, that if we asked you questions around those themes, either the racial equity lens or the fairness, or are people in different situations, whether demographic or geographic, are they being treated equally? Are you able to answer those questions, or do you even have that data available?
Chair Nathanson, in the vast majority, probably off the top of my head, all of that we would have to reach out to stakeholders. We would look at the data we have available to us. So certain things such as patterns in, for example, in demographics, it's like location of a violation, specific patterns in a particular area, that information generally is not readily available to us. I mean, we are beginning those conversations. So for example, in the health insurance arena, I do know that department staff are working with insurers in looking in that and creating the base for that information. I will say for this as well, not just specific to Division of Financial Regulation, but with throughout a number of our divisions, the information we gather is based upon statutes that are been around for quite some time. So for example, or even there's limitations in regards to access to data. So for example, in the workers' compensation arena, when an injured worker files a claim, it is typically they have what's called the Form 801, in which it is designed by nature, and there has been recent changes through the years. The most recent change actually is removal of having the requirement for a injured worker to put their social security number in the form. But the form is literally on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, and it's that way by design, again, for ease of access, and also because the general processes have been around for quite some time. So yes, it is conversations that we are having. Are they coming as fast as some would like? I mean, admittedly, I would guess that the answer for some is no. But when there's a question of that nature, we will do our best to provide as thorough of any response as we can by that. And actually, I would like to open it up for Katie and for Nathan to provide some feedback on this as well.
We have a question from Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, and thank you, Ms. Van Winkle. I just wanted to just clarify, can you tell me, do you collect race and ethnicity data on your forms, or is it forbidden? I think I heard you say that there's limitations. Just what data do you collect currently when it relates to race and ethnicity?
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Pham, I honestly would have to, in order to provide you with a thorough answer, I would have to do an inventory of all of the information that we collect, a lot of it, again, through licensure. I do know that there might be some information. So, for example, in workers' compensation claims, if there is the usage of interpretation services, that information, I believe, is given to us. So we can glean some information from that. I do know in regards to health insurance, we're working on that as well, on that piece as well. But again, we're working on that.
Thank you.
And Ms. Van Winkle, if you would like the other two DCBS people to make a statement, we have time for maybe 1 minute each before we need to move to Employment Department. Who would like to go next?
Chair Nathanson, this is Nathan Johnson. I'm a research analyst with the DCBS for the record and committee members. Briefly, I think the fact is most of our data is legacy based and paper form based. So historically the format of the delivery of that information to the agency has been the primary means. And historically, we have not had the opportunity to collect information that was not directly related and necessary for the capturing of business processes associated with those. However, as we transfer and migrate to new systems and new needs and new processes, opportunities always appear and we usually pursue those. Thank you.
Thank you for that comment. And is there one more?
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, this is Katie Whitehead. I'm the research manager for Department of Consumer and Business Services. I don't have a lot to add other than to echo what Nathan Johnson just contributed and what Teresa Van Winkle has shared already, that while we are able to get additional data through data calls when needed, most of what we collect on a regular basis is driven by past decisions in statute and rule. And we can certainly, as Teresa mentioned, we can do an inventory of where we have race and ethnicity captured. But to the best of my knowledge, it's not something that has been a part of most of our data collection over the years. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Yes, and actually, Chair Nathan said one more thing, and then that concludes my presentation, because I just want to focus specifically on Division Financial Regulatory Information. So with the registration systems that we use electronically for a large number of our licensure, it is based upon centralized vendors. So for example, in the what we call the non-depository programs within the Division Financial Regulation, we rely on the National Mortgage NMLS and their national database for that. And so we actually may have to look, as we dive into this a little further, we may also have to work with our partners in this arena to how we can quickly implement data collection in these areas. So that is another factor for us as well to consider.
Thank you for making us aware of that. I appreciate it. Rep. Pham?
Apologies, Madam Chair. That was my hand that I had not lowered.
That's fine. Thank you so much, Ms. Van Winkle, and the others for being with us. If you have the time, could you stick around in case another question comes up in the next hour or so?
I can do that.
Thank you. Let's move now to the Employment Department.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Pham, Vice Chair Reske, members of the committee. My name is Nick Belaychiks, and I'm the Systems and Economic Analysis Manager in the Workforce and Economic Research Division of the Oregon Employment Department. Part of the Employment Department's mission is to develop and distribute quality workforce and economic information to promote informed decision making. So we really appreciate this opportunity to talk about the data that we have and share on a daily basis and how it might help the committee. We truly do love this stuff. For today, I think it might help to frame Employment Department data as three main categories. That is, data that's collected for the purposes of Unemployment Insurance Administration, and data that is collected by our Workforce Operations Division to assist job seekers directly, and data that is collected by our Workforce and Economic Research Division, which I'm part of. So organizing it like that, I'll start with the Unemployment Insurance Administration data. And the basis to that is the quarterly reports that employers file with us when they pay their unemployment insurance tax. And that includes information about every employee. So you think about it organized by a social security number, every employee is in there. And one of the things we can do with that is identify small and large businesses based on their employment. So the number of businesses with fewer than 50 employees is a typical data request that our data can answer. The employers also provide quarterly wages paid for each employee and the number of hours worked. So we refer to these as wage records, and we can use our wage records, for example, to estimate the number of minimum wage jobs by county. That's another common analysis that we do. We also receive the unemployment insurance taxes paid by each employer. We know their industry, so we know the industry that all the employees work in, and we have information about location. And so we'll have the total employment by county, for example, and also in a GIS database that we can do any customized analysis for. That's total employment and total wages. For individuals, workers, we only really know where individual workers work if the employer has one location. So you can think about with a employer that has multiple locations, they're filing one report with all their workers, but we can't exactly place them all if they have multiple locations. That's the employer side of things. On the unemployment insurance recipient side of things, we collect weekly unemployment insurance benefits that are paid to recipients. So that's the number of people who file for or receive unemployment insurance benefits. And with that, we do get gender, age, location, and industry. We try to collect race, ethnicity, and occupation, but that data is limited. We ask that recipients report that, but we don't get 100% response rates, so it's a limited. There's a lot of unknowns, and that can make analysis difficult, but we do try to collect it, and we publish what we're able to collect, and our economists can help with the nuances of interpreting that incomplete data. We also submit required reports to the U.S. Department of Labor on a weekly or monthly basis, depending on the type of report. And those are used as economic indicators, such as the weekly unemployment insurance claims data that you'll sometimes hear on a Thursday. Oh, you know, employers laid off more people than economists thought. You might hear that nationally. That's one of those kind of economic indicator reports. And there's also program data that has to do with more of the accounting side to make sure everything's following U.S. Department of Labor rules. That's a brief summary of the data that's available from the unemployment insurance program. On the workforce operations side of things, we receive job listings from employers who reach out to us to tell us about the job vacancies they have that they're recruiting for. And that consists of variable information that's passed along to job seekers based on the occupation and the location of the job opportunity. And we also receive some information that's provided by registered job seekers when they are in our system because they're looking for a job. The third category is the workforce and economic research, and that's my division, so I'm more familiar with this sort of information, although I touch on all the other information in the course of our daily activities. But we publish a lot of information on our website, qualityinfo.org, and that's designed to help job seekers, policymakers, anyone who needs economic information that's tailored to Oregon and has to do with employment. The workforce and economic research, it consists of federal programs that we partner with the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics and the U.S. Census Bureau to provide things like quarterly employment and wages, monthly employment estimates. So if you hear about the number of jobs Oregon added in the last months, that would be from that source. Also the unemployment rate. So, you know, what Oregon's unemployment rate is doing, if it's going up or down, that's from our division. Occupational employment and wages, so breaking out all jobs into over 700 categories to figure out about how many registered nurses there are, for example, or a wage distribution from an average to medium wage of what different occupations pay. We also partner with the Census Bureau for a program called Quarterly Workforce Indicators, and that is a great source of information of the number of jobs by gender, rate, age, race, and ethnicity. And that's usually by county and industry. There's a similar program called On the Map that is more GIS based, and it can help measure commute flows of where the jobs are versus where people live. So those are some examples of our federal partnerships. Our division also conducts our own special surveys of employers. Since we have the database of all employers in Oregon, it's really easy for us to reach out to employers and collect information. So one of our regular ones is a quarterly job vacancy survey where we're asking employers what kind of job openings they have and how much they pay and what their requirements are, that sort of thing. Our division also conducts the construction prevailing wage survey on behalf of BOLI. So that's another example of a special survey that we conduct. We do one-off special surveys for other agencies when they request, or for our special economic analysis, such as our 2019 report on the types of benefits provided by employers in Oregon. We also do performance tracking. So we have our performance reporting information system called PRISM, which uses unemployment insurance wage records as indicators of the outcomes of customers who receive services from certain workforce or education programs. So TANF recipients, vocational rehabilitation recipients, SNAP recipients, people who receive Title I services, employment services, unemployment insurance, trade act, people who receive these programs, we can see how they're doing multiple quarters later in terms of were they able to find employment and did they receive a wage increase. Data collected by the employment department about individual people or employers is confidential under a variety of federal and state laws or rules. However, we are able to share data with federal, state, and local government agencies to the extent necessary to carry out government planning, performance measure, program analysis, socioeconomic analysis, and policy analysis functions performed under applicable law. So I'm quoting that. That sounds like a lot of legalese because it is. We take confidentiality seriously, but we do have roughly 100 such data sharing agreements with other agencies, and we'll try to share the data whenever possible as long as they can carry out their programs and keep the information confidential. Other than that, like I said, my division, my coworkers, we're spending all our time trying to get as much information about the economy out to whoever needs it. So that's it for my prepared remarks.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Committee, do you have questions? And if not right now, can you also stay with us in case a question comes up?
Absolutely, yes.
Thank you. Representative Levy.
I just have one comment. I just love that you started out the presentation that you love this. And not a lot of people can say that these days. So that was awesome to hear that you like what you're doing. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Levy. Let's move next to Department of Revenue.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. I am
Mr. Hart, we're having trouble hearing you. It's not muted, but the volume is very low.
Maybe if I speak up.
The closer you get, the better. I can hear you a little better now.
A little better. Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. I am John Hart, Interim Research Director at the Oregon Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss data generated by and used by the Department of Revenue. We do try to proactively make descriptive statistics about our largest programs available on our website, in addition to sharing special studies and the biennial tax expenditure report. I will note, of course, that your staff at the Legislative Revenue Office is very familiar with the data we generate and use. We support their work extensively, including by providing a sample of personal income tax return data that allows them to model tax changes independently and by kind of fulfilling ad hoc requests. They have statutory authorization to view individual level tax records and perform modeling on site at the Department of Revenue if they need to do that. Generally, our tax return data is confidential by statute, and we can't share individual level data, but we can share summary statistics. I'm gonna break up our data into a couple of categories. We have data on taxpayers for the dozens of programs that the department administers. We also have summary level data for property tax, and we have some administrative data as well. For tax returns, most programs for the Department of Revenue have a tax return, and the individual lines on those tax returns are available data that we can use for analysis. A couple of things to note about tax return data. Tax returns don't perfectly represent Oregon's population for a number of reasons. We have filing requirements so that the lowest income Oregonians are not filing tax returns. So we don't have those, and those requirements are roughly for a single person, about income of $6,500 is the threshold to file a return. And for married filing jointly, about $13,000. It's way more complicated than that, but that's the simple view. Tax returns also don't map perfectly to households. You can have dependents filing their own tax returns. You can have parents who live in a household together but aren't married, and that would be represented as two single tax returns and the like. The address for tax returns doesn't always represent the address of the taxpayer. For individuals, we think it's usually the home address, but it could be a tax preparer's address or a relative's address who helps prepare the return that they want to use for communication with the department. For businesses, it may not reflect the location of business activity, as the employment department, Nick, was saying earlier. Especially if there's multiple locations for a business, we may have one address and not know all the locations that the business activity is happening in. For most of our programs, the physical location of the business is not part of the tax calculation or part of the distribution, so we don't always collect the physical location. I also want to proactively answer the question about race and ethnicity. We don't collect race or ethnicity on tax forms. There are steps we could take with our data to make some inference about race and ethnicity versus the data that we do collect. But depending on the actual question, it may not be advisable to do that. For instance, for the mortgage interest deduction, if you look at claimants of the mortgage interest deduction within a zip code, and you compare that to census data on race in that zip code, you might find that homeownership itself is very much correlated with race, and so the tax returns don't well represent the race and ethnicity distribution of that provision. Finally, tax return information is available with a significant lag. So right now, we are finalizing the data for the 2019 tax year for individuals. So we have about a 16-month lag in the availability of data for individuals. We can make some inference again about more recent years, but we're really just finalizing the data from 2019. For corporate tax returns, it's more complicated again, but we have finalized data for 2018 for corporate tax returns. Also, we get third-party information that's relevant to administering the tax code. The third-party information includes W-2s and 1099s. We use that for compliance, and we can also use that for other reasons. We do get the wage files from the Employment Department, and we can use that in conjunction with tax return data for administration and to help with summary statistics if we need it. After tax returns, we have, for each individual taxpayer, we have transactions data that shows the timing of when they file a return and when they make payments. It helps us to calculate the balance for individual returns and track compliance actions. Once we can calculate a balance, we know accounts receivable, and we can look at payments, and we can look at audits and the results of audits from those transaction data. For property tax data, DOR, for the most part, receives only summary data from the counties. So we have something called the summary of assessments and levies each year, and the counties submit to us summary information on taxes imposed by local taxing districts, by type of property, and other eye-level summaries. We do also receive a report each year for counties on the amount of taxes imposed versus the amount collected. Because the detailed data on property tax accounts is kept by the counties themselves, including the real market value and assessed value for individual properties, we're not able to match that to our other programs in a comprehensive way. Also, other programs aren't collecting physical location of taxpayers, so there's difficulty in those matching exercises. DOR does also collect and generate administrative data about the actions of the department. For instance, we do have data on phone calls that we receive, how long the wait times are, that kind of thing, and on the page views for our web pages. With that, I've concluded what I have prepared, and I am all obviously willing to take questions and stick around for the rest of the hearing.
Thank you. That was really very interesting. Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Hart. You know, I heard you say that you aren't able to collect race and ethnicity data. Can you talk a little bit more about that? What are some of the obstacles to that, some of that data collection, or the challenges?
I apologize if it came across as not able to. We don't collect it. It's a very important question, whether we should collect that, and we're happy to support conversations in that direction. But right now, I don't think there's any legal barriers to collecting it.
Mr. Hart, with regard to information about tax returns, I understand that the information that would be available to us would be summary information, of course, because of the confidential nature of individual returns. But could you talk a little bit more about what we may or may not be able to learn from summary type analysis that either your policy and research people do, or the LRO people who come over to your shop to examine the information? What can we learn about the individual components of tax returns? For example, what taxpayers in what categories, or you know, whether it's by demographics, geography, whatever, take advantage of certain tax credits or deductions, or fall into certain income categories? How much of that is knowable?
Madam Chair, if it's a line on the return and we have enough information to report, we do report that. If you browse through our tax expenditure report, you'll find for tax credits where we have enough claimants, or for deductions where we have enough claimants, we provide a breakdown by income quintile. So I was talking about the mortgage interest deduction earlier. You can find the breakdown of claimants of the mortgage interest deduction by quintile in our tax expenditure report. And we do that every biennium. We also have more distributional information in our annual statistics report for the personal income tax and for the corporate excise and income taxes. And so we have those breakdowns by income in those reports that exist, and we share those. We really do share those whenever we can. So for the corporate excise and income tax, we will look at the credits with the largest number of claimants, and we will share distributions of those where we can. For instance, the tax expenditure report has a lot of provisions that we don't have data on because they are exclusions or because that data is not collected. If it's not used in the administration of tax, we don't necessarily know how it breaks down from tax return data. So, for instance, I don't think we have a way to know when someone sells their principal residence how much capital gain was excluded, because it's just not reported.
So some things could be knowable if we were asking for the information. One of the phrases you used in the first part of your response was, if there are enough returns. Can you say just a little bit more about what it takes to reach that threshold of enough.
Madam Chair, the statutes say that we can't release information that could be tied to an individual. And so we have some formal rules about what that might mean in different programs. With the personal income tax, for instance, if we're looking at a county level, I think we have to have 10 returns before we can provide a summary in a certain category. We have to have 10 returns in that category. For our corporate tax publication, I believe that the threshold we've used has been 5. We have to have about 5 returns. I think we will say 10 or fewer in a lot of our tables, and then we have to kind of blur more than one thing, so you can't do the algebra to come up with what number that is. But the situation we often find ourselves in is people want more and more breakdowns of something. And if we provided the number of claimants between $10,000 and $11,000 to one requester, and then somebody else asked us for $10,500 to $11,500, putting that information together could be a disclosure issue for us. And so we try to be careful, even kind of in a cumulative sense, with the number of claimants.
Very understandable. Thank you. And Nick, I know you're still with us, or at least I believe you are. I still see you in the room, and Mr. Hart has referred to you. I suppose that there are times when, if your agencies don't already collaborate, even though it might take some sort of an interagency agreement, you might be able to work together for us to have a better understanding of, in certain categories, with certain kinds of, this would be in the area of business entities, certain kinds of things, if we could match some of the information from Department of Revenue with your information from employment and better understand, well, yes, we know the income or income information from DOR, but what if we want to also cross-reference that to number of employees? Because income doesn't always match to number of employees.
Chair Nathanson, yes. I think if we had a common denominator with that could identify the type of business, we could attach the number of employees to that business. And the Department of Revenue may have that information and already, and I don't know if they've looked into that, because we already do have data sharing agreements with the Department of Revenue.
Good, thanks.
Yes. Yes, Madam Chair, there are ways that we can look at that, including just from our W-2s. I think we can add up the W-2s issued by an employer and even look at the residence, for instance, of the employees.
Great. Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hart, I just had a question about confidentiality. You mentioned the need to protect confidentiality, and I understand that for individuals, of course, we need to protect individuals' confidentiality, but I don't quite understand the, you mentioned that corporations also need confidentiality, or up to, you know, you make sure that there's at least 5 corporations. Can you explain some of the rationale for needing to protect? I understand perhaps if it was like a trade secret or something, but I imagine that tax returns. I guess I didn't expect. I often hear companies say, "Oh, we made this much in profit and this much in, you know, if they're benefiting from a tax break, for example." I can see a lot of public good that would come from being able to get a little more transparency into a corporation as opposed to an individual. Can you speak a little bit to that distinction?
Madam Chair, Representative. So the confidentiality that we need to protect comes from statutory requirements. So it's a policy of the legislature. It's not necessarily a policy of the department. We follow the statutes that require basically the same confidentiality protection for almost all of our tax programs.
Interesting. Thank you so much. I'll have to follow up more on that.
Mr. Hart, if there isn't anything else.
Madam Chair, I see Rep. Levy.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Pham. Thank you, Chair Nathanson. So, Jonathan, I just want to clarify one thing. So, it's my understanding as a taxpayer that my individual tax information is not public knowledge any more than a privately held corporation's tax information is public knowledge. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Levy, yes, that's correct. We protect the tax returns in the same way, based on our statutory requirements.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that it was the same for corporations as it was for individuals. Thank you.
Anything else for Mr. Hart before we move to Business Oregon? Okay, let's hear from Business Oregon next.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Myers. I'm an economist with Business Oregon. Thank you for having me today. My presentation, I'll kind of break up into two pieces primarily. The first piece will be talking about primary data collection and analysis, primary data being data that we collect as an agency. And then the other part will be about secondary data collection and analysis, which is data that others collect that we use for some of our analyses. And so those are kind of the two main buckets that the presentation's broken up into. So Business Oregon is not a regulatory agency, and that we don't collect taxes and related information from citizens or businesses, nor do we enforce standards or laws generally across a wide segment of the population or the business community. So as a result, Business Oregon does not collect large amounts of primary data that would be considered useful for macroeconomic analysis in general. But Business Oregon does collect some primary data, which can be used for analysis and decision-making, and some of those examples will be presented. In particular, Business Oregon relies on data collected by state agencies and federal agencies for some of its performance metrics, program analysis, competitive industry analysis, regional analysis, and innovation analysis. We really rely on quarterly census of employment and wage data and unemployment insurance tax record data from the Oregon Employment Department, which Nick presented. So going into primary data collection and analysis, there's kind of three categories here. One is program data. So Business Oregon operates many different economic and community development programs, most of which collect some primary data from applicants and recipients of program dollars. Most of the program data collected represents very small portions of the general population or business community to be useful for macroeconomic analysis. Program data is collected in some cases for program analysis and evaluation for decision makers. Some of our program data, like from our Certification Office for Business Inclusion and Diversity, or COBID, is used by outside agencies for their decision-making. So in that case, that's for government contracting. But the most common form of program data and analysis is statistics on how many projects, loans, grants, et cetera, were completed or awarded over a given time period, say a fiscal year. And then, in addition to that, how many program dollars were expended on those. So summaries of our program data analysis are presented in our annual report. They're also found on our website. And we also present them to the legislature during our Ways and Means presentation and to other committees as requested. Another category of primary data are surveys. We don't have any regular surveys that we conduct in terms of for macroeconomic data, but we do on occasion conduct surveys to gather economic data on subjects or issues for which data is lacking. So an example would include a survey that we did on onshoring in 2012, onshoring being the opposite of offshoring. We were trying to gather information on Oregon-based companies who are involved in bringing employees back here that were previously offshored. A more recent example would be a survey that we conducted in partnership with Travel Oregon and the Oregon Small Business Development Network that collected information on impacts of COVID-19 on Oregon businesses. So that data collected collected information on impacts that didn't duplicate data collection on things like employment and unemployment, for which we already have existing surveys that capture that data, but rather complemented that data and helped fill in gaps on impacts that wasn't captured by those surveys. And then the last category of primary data that we collect that I'll talk about, and it's our newest category of data, is demographic data. One of our newest data collection efforts revolves around collection of demographic data of business owners that participate in our programs. This demographic data is being collected to inform decision makers of the efforts of programs to provide services to underserved communities and business owners. So Business Oregon intends to collect demographic information. When I say demographic information, that would be the basic categories: sex, race, ethnicity, and others, from all business owners who participate in our programs that serve businesses going forward. So the first program for which we have collected comprehensive demographic data from business owners was the Emergency Business Assistance Grant Program, which provided grants to Oregon small businesses last year impacted by COVID-19. So analysis of that demographic data was recently completed and presented last week to the House Committee on Economic Recovery and Prosperity. So demographic data from this program and others will be used, like I said, by decision makers to evaluate outreach efforts and ensure equity in our program administration going forward. And then the last category of data analysis that we're involved with is secondary data. So this is data, again, from other state and federal agencies. As I mentioned earlier, we rely a lot on this data to conduct a lot of our analyses. We rely on it for program analysis, performance metrics, competitive industry analysis, regional analysis, and innovation analysis. The federal agencies that collect a lot of this information, you probably heard of, the U.S. Census Bureau, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and the Bureau of Economic Analysis, as well as the state agencies represented here. I do specifically want to call out, again, the Employment Department for being an excellent state data partner over the years. They've always been willing to work with us and provide us the employment and wage data that helps us analyze our agency's performance in our programs. And so I just want to say, you know, thanks to them in particular for being a great partner over the years. Business Oregon's key performance measures 1, 2, and 3 rely on confidential employment and wage record data from the Employment Department for that analysis. We use that data to count actual jobs created and retained at Oregon businesses that have received direct financial assistance from the department and its programs. And while every state economic development agency around the country has job creation and job retention metrics, Business Oregon is unique in that we're one of the only ones that consistently relies on actual employment and wage record data of businesses from the state's employment, or in other states' cases, Commerce Department, to measure jobs created and retained rather than relying on self-reported data or estimates from models. So Business Oregon also uses OED data and data from other federal agencies for many different analyses that I've mentioned to help decision makers evaluate programs, inform policy analysis, identify business development prospects throughout Oregon, and develop strategies to improve economic prosperity throughout the state. Some of the key analyses and reports that rely on this secondary data include target industry groups, regional competitive industry reports, the Oregon Innovation Index, and distressed areas. All these reports can be found on our website, oregon4biz.com. Thank you.
And thank you, Ms. Moss, for your presentation. Any questions for Mr. Myers before we move to Office of Economic Analysis? Okay, and now batting cleanup. We're ready for Office of Economic Analysis.
All right, thank you, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Pham, Vice Chair Reschke, Mark McMullen, Oregon State Economist. So thanks for having us. I did, of course, being naked without my slides, I did prepare a couple of them for you. So I don't know if Corinne or someone can pull those up, but it's not going to help much with the first one, because the first one is this crazy table of a bunch of the data we use. But believe me, it could be a lot crazier. Given that this is really just a piece of all, we're data folks, and this is just a piece of the inputs that we have. What we've gathered here is really the backbone of our economic and demographic forecast, the stuff that really that we forecast mostly and what really drives most of our models. But it's missing a lot. A couple of big categories of things that this table would be missing. One is any real-time or leading indicator type of indicators that we look at, all sorts of things, you know, unemployment claims, orders for capital equipment, bankruptcies, you know, wait mile taxes on the roads, all sorts of things to try to get an idea before the actual data comes out, to try to get an idea if things are turning bad or turning good or whatnot. Yeah, but, you know, these are more of this indicator approach is more of a tea leaf thing, where it's more holistic, because these individual indicators aren't really, most of them aren't really solid enough to put in any kind of formal model. But this is what you're going to see a lot of right now. If you're talking about the impact of COVID and what's going on with different races and ethnicities and stuff, when you do see things in the newspaper or articles about it, most of these are based on these real-time third-party data sets that people are really trying to mine to get an idea of what's going on before we because we're still waiting on a lag before we can really get some solid data to look at. So they look at things like, you know, payroll processor data and reservations on your open table dining service and the like to get an idea of what's going on. The problem is a lot of this is really shaky, you know, and one example just about a month ago got picked up by all the major papers was an outfit called Opportunity Insights, a really solid place, but they're trying to maybe make bricks without straw with some of this real-time data. And so it came out that Oregon had the largest loss of low-wage workers across all 50 states during the pandemic, and that almost half of all of our restaurants have closed. Well, that obviously doesn't pass the sniff test. And you walk down the street and realize that not half of the restaurants are closed, but we have other data like the OLCC licenses and the video lottery terminals that would suggest that the number, while bad, is much, much smaller than that. And so, you know, we had to push back on them. They stopped publishing some of their stuff about Oregon in the interim. But nevertheless, this is what we're working with now, is a lot of this real-time stuff that you're seeing. The other chunk that's missing from this table are a lot of our big U.S. or macroeconomic driver variables. What's going on with retail trade or industrial production or prices or stock market at the U.S. level? That's all, of course, inputs to our models as well, but just to try to make this a little bit more legible. Those are all missing out. So what's in here? Well, those first two columns, the monthly and quarterly stuff, you've heard a lot about this from OED and DOR and the like. And this is, again, the backbone of our model, the income, the employment, the actual tax numbers. But most of this is really all at the very high top level. It's all aggregate stuff, totals. So we're not getting particularly any of this race or ethnicity, racial or ethnicity data other than the employment at the U.S. level you see down below. But it's not just the race and ethnicity where we'd like more detail here. You see, we do have detail in some of these data sets in terms of industry mix or counties and regions of the state, but even that's shaky for a few months until we get to the revisions and get the hard data when we're looking at some of this small sample data and the like. And so it's not very reliable either in the near term. So this is the stuff that we get, you know, monthly or quarterly. And like I say, is really the heart of our main models. But now to get into the questions of race and ethnicity, it's all about that census data. And in particular, you see here, once a year, we get this, the American Community Survey, which gives us all sorts of great stuff in terms, and this is just a part of it that we've listed here, in terms of the breakdowns of all our incomes and our home ownership and disabilities, all sorts of things that policymakers would be interested in studying. And so this comes about once a year, and then you see at the end, every 3 years, we also get some information from the Federal Reserve on credit conditions of different households, and that also is broken up by race and ethnicity. So once a year, we do get this stuff. The 10-year census will help. It doesn't add that much. It gives us a good anchor for all of these numbers from year to year. But in terms of this breakdown and the equity questions, there isn't a whole lot more information in the 10-year than there is in the single-year census. There's one exception to that that I'm really excited about this time around with the 10-year census is in terms of tribal populations. So we've seen over the last decade that our people in Oregon who identify as Native or Indigenous are growing very rapidly over time. But what we don't have is tribal affiliation. We only get that every 10 years. And a lot of the folks now that are identifying as Indigenous or Native don't affiliate with a traditional North American tribe. And so it'll be very interesting to see, you know, how our tribes have evolved over this last 10 years in terms of our their population. But that's just one example. For the most part, it's all in that ACS data, which I summarize a little bit on the next slide. So that this American Community Survey data, the one issue is it's the lag. And that's what's really frustrating right now, because we'd really like to know what's happened with this equity lens during the pandemic. Big question, but we're not going to get into for another 6 months, we're not going to get the 2020 numbers. And so for now, we're kind of flying blind. But here in September of this year, we'll start getting the first numbers from the census that relate to 2020. And then in December, we'll get the micro data, which is really key for answering all the detailed policy questions that you folks are interested in. And so here's what was happening with the ACS data up till 2019, pre-pandemic. We were seeing some really wonderful advances in terms of equity and closing disparities. Here you're looking at Black, Indigenous, and people of color, the poverty rate relative to white, non-Hispanic. Still a big gap there in terms of Black, Indigenous, and people of color having higher poverty rates, but that gap had narrowed significantly, and it was at an all-time low going into the pandemic. And that just illustrates what we know in our world is from, you know, in our world of the economics, the one thing that really helps these disparities or inequities is a long expansion. The long, strong period of economic growth, the whole decade-long expansion was great, because when you're in a situation where you have real tight markets and things are running hot, the benefits really trickle down to more and more folks in terms of you know, if I'm hiring and workers are scarce, maybe give someone an opportunity that wouldn't have gotten one otherwise. Or if I'm looking for suppliers and I need, you know, and there's, you know, suppliers are very busy, I might have to look to new suppliers or new regions of the state in order to satisfy my demand. And so anyway, so we don't know yet 2020, but we will, you know, we will here at the end of the year in December. And given that, we have a great demographer on staff, we can really parse this out into how many prime age Oregonians were incarcerated, you see here, or what occupations do Asian Oregonians work from home the most, and things like any kind of policy question you want to ask. Now, that said, there's always the small sample caveat that as we start parsing this smaller and smaller, that we do have issues in terms of not just the sample being small, but we redacted data for privacy reasons, right? If there are two or three Black hotel managers in a given census tract, that data will be redacted so that to protect privacy and the like. So it looks like there is a question, Chair Nathanson. If
Representative Reschke, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. McMullen. In this graph here where you've drawn by basically two racial groups, I'm just wondering if either of those leans heavier towards particular industries or not. They seem to track pretty well until we get to about 2000 and looks like mid 2010, 11, whatever. And then we see kind of those lines getting closer together, which is a good thing in my view. But I'm just wondering if industries that workers choose to work in plays an effect on the disparity between these lines.
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. And we do know that a lot of Black, Indigenous, and people of color are in low-wage industries, and that's the same true for our Hispanic population in a lot of our lower-wage industries. And so that does make sense. And as we go through the business cycle, you know, the mix of industries does matter in occupations, whereas in our typical recessions, we really see these middle-wage industries getting hit the hardest, and over time, and this polarization increases, and you can do a mapping fairly well across occupations to ethnicity. And I have tried. Again, the sample is small, but going into looking at the occupations in Oregon, there were a lot more folks in these front-facing consumer service industries from Black, Indigenous, people of color in those groups as well. And also on the business ownership side, where we see Black, Indigenous, and people of color own restaurants at very high rates relative to non-Hispanic whites. And so there are some, you know, you can do some mapping here. But again, it's, you know, we have to be careful when we start parsing it too much that we get into such a small sample size that it loses some of its, value.
Madam Chair, a quick follow-up as well. I think you're on mute.
Before we do that, I want to do a quick time check. We have a question from Rep. Pham, and I want to allow a few minutes at the end for the committee members to have any concluding remarks or reactions or comments about all this information that we've been receiving this afternoon. And I think we can extend our meeting just a little beyond 2:45. So yes, Rep. Rischke, go ahead. And after that will be Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And real quick, Mr. McMullen, do we have data that maps by ethnicity, education status as far as higher education degrees and or trade school, not degrees, but completions that might also explain some of this disparity?
Yes, Representative Rasky, that's right off the shelf. And the Oregon, in the governor's budget summary, I included a chart on that.
Thank you very much.
Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I thank you so much, Mark, for this helpful information. And I'm just trying to, I'm curious, what are your thoughts? It seems like you, the OEA mostly collects data from other sources. What kind of data would be helpful to you that isn't being currently collected as you're trying to do this analysis of other data sources? Because I think you did a really great presentation on, you kind of already know what we as policymakers are trying to look for. And so you as an analyst, what are some of the areas where you wish you had more data? And that might be an interesting question. I'm curious for all of the agencies as their last remarks, where now that we've seen this whole presentation and they understand some of our interests, if they have some suggestions or recommendations for some of the gaps that we need more data on, I would be very interested in hearing.
Oh no, the wish list, yeah, it would be very long. I'm very interested in a lot of the corporate breakdown. Sometimes the corporate data is very hard to both geolocate and figure out what's going on with them. I'd love a lot more data on pass-through entities, businesses that pay through the personal income tax. What's the nature of them, and you know who and what kind of stuff's coming along there? And the demographic data would be great. Before my time here, 15, 20 years ago, we actually had an Oregon population survey that the only time our office ever actually gathered primary data. And although costly, boy, that would be great to, you know, ask the laundry list of questions with that. So I'm sorry about the time, Representative Nathanson. I did have a couple more charts that Josh was going to talk about it on the what we do have from the employment department so far and the challenges with those employment numbers across race and ethnicity.
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay. Afternoon, everyone. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Lanner, Office of Economic Analysis. And this is, you know, this would be a top of my list among these data sets that we're using, would be increased funding for larger sample sizes so that we could get better information at a state and local level. And these last two charts are designed to look at employment by race and ethnicity in the U.S. and here in Oregon. And you can see overall, the Bureau of Labor Statistics only publishes three pieces of information really on a regular basis: total employment for white Americans, Asian Americans, and black Americans. And that's it. But you can go in and you can crunch the numbers yourself and you can see overall the chart in front of you, right? High level total employment changes by a wider swath of the population, or at least segmented a little bit more based upon self-reported race and ethnicity. And overall, it tends to make sense. It makes, you know, overall, we're seeing similar patterns across the country within a relatively small band of a few percentage points. Now, if we go to the next slide, please, you'll see the exact same information, but for Oregon. And here, this is not to talk about the specifics here. This is not NIC's fault. This is not the employment department's fault. This has entirely due to the sample size that's available at the federal level. This monthly household survey goes out to about 60,000 households across the country. It goes out to about 950 to 1,000 households here in Oregon, which is about less than 0.1% of the overall number of households. So it's a really, really small sample size. And then once you start breaking that down by occupation or industry or race and ethnicity, you get really, really noisy data. And so while at the U.S. level, you could see everything was within a few percentage points of each other, here in Oregon, if we do the exact same calculation, at least upon what's available to us as researchers, employment in Oregon is plus or minus 25-50%. So you can see the range of numbers here is incredibly large, and we've seen massive swings within the last year that don't make a lot of intuitive sense given everything else we know about the economy and what's happened during the pandemic. And so this is the main reason why this information isn't published, and this is more of an informational purposes only chart. It is available. You can calculate this yourself, but we're never going to use this because, it's not helpful. The conversation to know what's going on in Oregon in real time, because those sample sizes are so small. So if we could, you know, bother our congressional delegation to increase funding for the Census Bureau and for the Bureau of Labor Statistics to augment these surveys so that they are useful at a more granular level, that would certainly be very helpful for people around the country, not just here in Oregon. And that was it for our prepared remarks. Thank you.
Thank you both. I appreciate that. And if the governor's office wasn't listening, the governor does have some connection to lobbying in Washington, D.C. On federal issues, but each of us also has a congressional delegation that we can alert to that. So, committee members, do you have any closing remarks? Or if you can stay with us for a few minutes, I would first call on any of the previous presenters. I see that many of you are still with us in the room. If there's anything that you would like to add at the end of our meeting today, before the committee members make some final comments. I'll wait a minute to see if any hands go up. Okay, committee members. Yes, Mr. Myers, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you. In response to Representative Pham's question, you know, what kind of additional data would we like? One thing that did spring to mind for me is this kind of growing movement for, and I'm going to probably mess up the name, and maybe Nick at the employment department can help me, but for enhanced wage record data. And so there's kind of this movement, not just in, nationally, to try to attach more data to the wage record data that comes out of the states, whether that's occupational codes or demographics. That could be a real big game changer as well, to have additional data attached to the wage records, individual wage record data. That would help us do some great analysis as well. So I don't know if Nick wants to make any comments about that, but it's something that there's been a little bit of movement nationally. And I know I've talked to Nick and Bob there at the employment department about it, so.
Yes, Chair Nathanson, I can add a little bit to that if you like. As Mike mentioned, the enhanced wage record is the idea that when employers report to us their unemployment insurance taxes and they tell us who works for them and how much they paid them during that quarter, that's all the information that's really needed to administer the unemployment insurance program. So all states have that sort of information. Oregon and three other states, including Washington, have an additional requirement where we're asking for the number of hours worked. And that really increases the amount of analysis we can do, because instead of just quarterly, we have wages, we have quarterly and hours, which allows us to do minimum wage analysis. So right there, we have an advantage over a lot of states over the types of analysis we can do with the wage file. And then the enhanced wage records idea is, what else could we add to that? Could we have employers also report gender, race, ethnicity, any other sort of information that would increase our ability to do analysis of that? That idea is handled in some sense by the Census Bureau, and I mentioned some of the data sources we have that can talk about employment by race, ethnicity, age, and gender, where the Census Bureau is using other federal records to get that demographic information, match it with state unemployment insurance information, and create a new data source for that type of analysis. But it would be it doesn't include occupations, as an example, or some of the other things that are talked about, what could be used in an enhanced wage record collection.
Thank you both for those additional comments. Anyone else on the committee? It's your turn now. Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to express appreciation to all of the presenters today. As a legislator, I'm very committed to making sure that the laws that we pass and the work of our government agencies is fair, and there's fair treatment of every Oregonian, regardless of their gender or their race and ethnicity. And we can only do that with good data. So I really appreciate your presentations, and I look forward to working with each agency, each individual, and to figure out how we can do the work of governance even better with better data. So thank you.
Rep. Valderrama.
Try this again. Thank you, Madam Chair. I also just wanted to thank all of the presenters for the information today. It's always really great to hear how impactful this type of data can be in our efforts as policymakers, and so appreciate the time today. I especially am interested in learning more about not only the race and ethnicity data, and even digging a little deeper in disaggregated data there, but also around language and disability. I think especially as we all know in COVID and in these times of economic downfall, it's particularly helpful to know how we can do what we can for our districts and for our communities. And so getting that data is particularly important for us and I think for everyone. And then I think the only other thing that I'll share is that I am just excited to learn more from you all and to support us in figuring out how to get some of that information, get some of that data. I think that it sounds like we're all really committed to lifting up and talking more about those pieces. And so I'm looking forward to that. So thank you.
And welcome to the committee. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to add my voice to the choir. I thought today was extraordinarily productive. You know, over the years, I've had a chance to work with many of the folks who spoke today, and they always do an A-plus job. So thank you for allowing us to be reminded. Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you again to all of the presenters. Mr. Alanak, final thoughts on today's presentation or other business of the committee?
Madam Chair, I guess my two cents is similar in that I hope if this goes as hoped, this is just one more piece of the foundation for the committee members in building the information that is necessary to develop good policy for the state. And it's really just the beginning of more questions. So probably not the answer to many, hopefully just the basis and the beginning of more questions to come.
Thank you. This informational meeting has concluded. There's no other business before us today. We're adjourned.